Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Six U.S. soldiers were killed this week in a suicide attack near Bagram in Afghanistan.
There have been very low casualties for a very long time, and that this constitutes really quite a significant event precisely because we're not used to it and haven't seen anything like it for some time.
That's Nicholas Haysom, the U.S. envoy to Afghanistan, speaking at the U.N. earlier this week. Meanwhile, the Taliban seems poised to take over the city of Sangin, where coalition forces fought some of their deadliest battles. In the last decade, dozens of Marines died fighting for the city in Helmand, along with hundreds of British soldiers. A surge of troops in 2010 brought some hard-earned calm to the area, but peace proved fleeting there. Now, with coalition troops gone, conflict has moved in again, just months after a Taliban offensive briefly took over the northern city of Kunduz. But author Mike Martin says the entire focus on the Taliban misses a key truth in Afghanistan. Mike Martin served in Helmand. He was there as a British military officer. He's also author of An Intimate War, An Oral History of the Helmand Conflict. And he says what Westerners are told is a war with the Taliban isn't the Taliban at all.
What's really been happening with the, you know, if I put the word Taliban in inverted commas, is there's a bit of a shifting mosaic, and people leave, people join. Often the reason people are fighting is because of land or water or blood feuds or honour or so on and so forth. And what the Taliban Shura in Quetta, which is just over the border in Pakistan, did is they provided legitimacy to a whole bunch of different people that were fighting for different reasons. And in some cases, they provided funding. Although more often than not, the people in Helmand province who were fighting, British troops and American troops, were self-funding through poppy or smuggling or various other things.
Then given the difference between an organized Taliban and just sort of a branded Taliban, is there a direct connection between what we're seeing in Helmand province and, say, the conflict several months ago when Taliban forces briefly overtook Kunduz? Is that the same organization or, again, just a matter of semantics?
If I were just to take one district in Helmand and I wanted to aggregate all the different conflicts and fights in that district, it would be very hard to design one framework that would fit all those conflicts in, because some would be about water, some would be about the fact that British soldiers have killed their relative or so on and so forth. To aggregate the conflicts in Helmand and in Kunduz, I think is ridiculous. So to take Kunduz, for instance, up there you have a large Pashtun immigrant community who was settled there in the 1800s by an Afghan king called Abdul Rahman. That's created community tension, effectively between the natives, the guys who were there before the 1880s, and the Pashtun communities who were transported from the south and the east. So that conflict and all the sub-conflicts that make it up are overlaid with this government Taliban narrative. Go to Helmand. Well, let's have a look at Sangin, which is why we're talking today. I could talk you through a long history of that, but you know, let's just pick three things. We've got the district boundaries drawn in 1964 that were basically gerrymandered to bring together a weird collection of tribes. You've got a drugs war going on between two of the main tribes, the Alakazai and the Ishaqzai. And then you've got water issues stretching up the Sangin Valley up towards the Kajaki Dam. And you've got access to irrigation water and believe it or not, flood protection. And so you've got all of these issues, and then a whole bunch of clans and tribes jockeying around these issues. Add on to that, you know, all the layers of conflict from American soldiers being there, British soldiers being there, feuds, so on and so forth. It's almost impossible to overlay a binary dichotomy on it. This is much, much, much more complicated. And to overlay a simple black, white, good, bad Taliban government dichotomous narrative over it is to court failure, because everyone realizes that that's how you interpret the conflict, and all the Helmandis will come up to you and all the information they give you will be given to you within that framework. And so when they say to you, ah, yes, Mike, the Taliban are all the way over there, and this happened, this personal experience happened to me all the time, Mike, the Taliban are over there. What they actually meant was, that village over there is a village that we've been having a feud with for the last 50 years, and would you mind please going and attacking it? This happened all the time.
Well, then, Mike Martin, if that's the case, and we're looking at a mosaic of localized, regionalized conflicts in many ways, that then raises the question to me about whether this is really the concern of British soldiers or American soldiers or NATO. Certainly we want a stable and peaceful Afghanistan because we don't want the next Al-Qaeda to rise up there. But if it's a water issue at the dam or a local tribal issue, I'm not sure that that's our concern.
Special Operations Force is going to help. So let's break a few myths, shall we? One of the myths that's often bandied about is that Western troops are good at stabilizing, you just use the word yourself, stabilizing countries. Right. I would like to propose that Western military forces are not very good at stabilizing Muslim tribal societies. All the evidence of the last 15 years shows that we are actually awful at it. And if you ask most Homanis, I'll tell you that it's the Westerners who bring the instability. To go back to your point more directly, absolutely, you know, stable, prosperous Afghanistan is in everyone's favor. It's in our favor, it's in their favor. The question is, when you've had a civil war going on for 40 years, adding resources, be they development resources or military resources, it's just like pouring petrol onto a smoldering fire. Arguably, the best thing you could do is to leave that well alone and convince the neighboring countries also to leave it well alone. Sure, you allow in humanitarian stuff, but weaponry, money, development project, these sorts of things aggravate the conflict. Because if you pour resources into a political situation that you don't understand, people jockey and they fight for those resources and it makes it more unstable. This is exactly what's going to happen in Sangin.
Mike Martin, this is a dose of reality about the conflict in Afghanistan that I don't think most Americans have heard, and I thank you for giving it to us. Mike Martin is author of An Intimate War, An Oral History of the Helmand Conflict. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Todd.
So as the Taliban retakes hard-won territory, a new investigation looks at the money behind the madness in Afghanistan, a country teetering still on the brink of disaster.
It faces a lot of difficulties. The biggest one is security. No one's going to invest if you're being shot at. The second difficult situation you're dealing with is the corruption. Serious problem. Nobody's going to invest faced with such endemic corruption.
That's John Sopko. He's Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. He was talking with The Takeaway back in October. Sopko's reports formed the basis of a new investigation by Megan McCloskey. She's defense reporter for ProPublica. McCloskey looked at rebuilding efforts in Afghanistan into the billions of dollars the U.S. has wasted there, often to little effect.
Well, the total that we found in questionable spending is $17 billion, and it covers everything from about 2009 on, and it could be roads, buildings, schools, hospitals, also quite a bit of money that has gone into building the Afghan army and police, training their buildings, their equipment like helicopters.
But also things as deep as anti-drug efforts, poppy eradication, giving Afghanistan sort of a financial alternative to the drugs trade, all of these things.
Sure. Yeah, we put $8.4 billion into countering narcotics in Afghanistan and trying to get them to grow legal crops. Afghanistan is the world leader in poppy production. They grow more poppy than they did before the war.
Now, as you said, we could be talking about schools, we could be talking about buildings. Let's talk about roads, because it seems like roads is a ubiquitous problem that has really turned into a boondoggle. What's going on with American money for Afghan roads?
We have sunk $2.4 billion into roads in Afghanistan, both to build them and to maintain them. And there's a bunch of problems. One, there is an active insurgency. And so every time we build a road, it often gets blown up again. It's also expensive to maintain asphalt. Like if you are just driving around in the U.S., we have lots of potholes and we have a pretty good infrastructure. So you can imagine in a country like Afghanistan that doesn't have the kind of tax base that we do to pay for construction, they simply can't afford to keep up the roads. So we have put a lot of money into building them, and then they're falling apart. The UN says 85% of Afghanistan roads are undrivable.
So as we pour this $2.5 billion into roads, it seems like there's also either an Afghan unwillingness or inability to do that maintenance, quite apart from a war situation, just normal wear and tear. It seems like we've paved all these things with no plan to keep them paved.
Absolutely. That's a problem throughout our efforts in reconstruction. We pay no attention to sustainability, long-term upkeep. We had very grand plans building this first world infrastructure, but Afghanistan doesn't have the funds, doesn't have the technical expertise to maintain roads, to maintain the buildings. We'll build a school that'll have some complex heating system that the Afghans don't know how to do and is too expensive to keep up. And you see this over and over again.
So what's the issue here at home? What's the issue in the Pentagon and the State Department and USAID? Is this a wartime culture that says the military gets what it wants and we're not going to look over their shoulder because it's wartime? And if the general wants to build a road, the general can build a road. Is it as simple as that? Or is it some more systemic lack of accountability that's going on here?
I think it's both. And certainly in a wartime situation, the military gets a very long leash and billions, if not trillions of dollars to spend how it wants. And there is also a cultural lack of accountability on these projects. You don't see anybody who is held accountable for blowing $500 million on planes that we could never really get off the ground because there weren't enough spare parts. And so 20 planes were scrapped for metal. And that just happens, and nobody is ever held responsible. Then there's also this issue of the military being in the lead for reconstruction. They spent most of the money. They were the ones who had the most people on the ground. And they had a very large hearts and mind campaign and thought that they would be able to buy peace and prosperity. And nobody has really challenged that strategy at home, and USAID and state have kind of had to go along with it. But we really haven't seen any sort of public reckoning of if this was a good idea.
So this raises the question then whether we're just talking about kind of standard political waste, bad accounting, no quality control, no follow through, or if this is really about the folly of nation building itself. Those are two separate questions. Which of those things is it?
The bigger issue is the folly of nation building, whether or not you can do that successfully. And I actually asked that question to almost everyone I talk to, generals, ambassadors. And I said, is the lesson that we've learned from all this is that we're just really bad at nation building. Maybe we shouldn't do it anymore. And all of them said yes, but that inevitably we will probably do it again. And so then the question becomes, maybe it needs to be done better. And how do you do it better? And then that's answering the question of accountability and systemic waste and having some sort of structure that really does reconstruction as a whole instead of piecemeal.
$17 billion spent on what you call waste in the story leads me to believe, in fact, to know that it's not just money wasted. Somebody got very, very rich off of all this construction. Who is making all of the billions that are being spent? Is the Army building these roads themselves, or do we have contractors who are in Afghanistan making out with all of this American largesse?
We have contractors making a lot of money. And not just contractors, we have consultants. Almost every project seems to have an additional firm that's consulting on it. And there are some cases where the Army's doing the building. They have the U.S. Corps of Army Engineers. But for the most part, particularly with USAID projects, it's all contractors and it's all American contractors. And they get a very large sum of money. And then they subcontract out the work to Afghan contractors on the ground. So quite a bit of this reconstruction money has come home.
An estimated $17 billion wasted on construction, on training, on the Iraqi army, on drug eradication in Afghanistan. Is anyone paying attention? Has anyone learned a lesson? Has Congress? Has the military? Megan McCloskey of ProPublica says probably not. Megan McCloskey, thank you so much.
Thank you.